Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Who's the person you turn to for love advice? Who knows how you're doing and notices when something's wrong? Is it your mom, your best friend, or how about the man who sells you charcuterie? Well, Catherine Down's essay is called Need to Find Me? Ask My Ham Man. It's read by Jenny Slate. Jenny has a special on Netflix called Stage Fright. She's also out with a new book called Little Weirds.
The man who sells me ham is the first person who would notice if I were dead. Experience supports this claim. When my grandmother died unexpectedly 3 years ago, I left Paris for the funeral without warning any of my local shopkeepers. This led my charcuterie salesman to believe that I myself was dead. Alarmed by my continued absence and aware of my daily dining route, he hurried across the street to my wine guy to see if he had any news of me. I'm the human equivalent of a stray dog who wanders from shop to shop in search of whoever will give me a snack. My wine guy hadn't seen me in days either, so he called my friend, who explained about the family emergency. When I finally returned from Boston, there was no need to explain where I had been. The whole neighborhood had been alerted. And they turned out with hugs, condolences, even chocolates. The ham shop is barely larger than a coffin and stacked floor to ceiling with pig parts. I come for the snowballs, baseballs of sausage stuffed with black truffles and coated in Parmesan cheese. I stay for the company. The ham man is the biggest ham of all. He knows about every bad date I have. He even gave my phone number to a stranger he thought I would like. I didn't. Ours is not exactly the normal relationship between a shopkeeper and patron, but then again, not one of my food-based friendships is what you'd call normal. I Snapchat with my cheesemonger. My barista lets me sneak in last night's open bottle of champagne to wash down my morning donut. My chocolatier's daughter, studying in New York, has my sister's number in case of emergencies. I have cried into my wine guy's sweater more times than I can count. Most recently, when he moved away and I felt as if someone had cut off my limb. Where would I drink and weep now? At home? Like a normal person? My cousin was shocked last fall when we walked into my other wine shop and my wine cellar, Patty, who is also an astrologer and tarot reader, said that she had been debating whether to call me about something she had seen in my astrology chart. Your wine cellar has your phone number? My cousin asked. Of course she has my number, I thought. How would I be able to confidently make terrible life choices if my wine-selling astrologer couldn't reach me? How have I made all of these food friends in Paris? I compulsively seek out people who are trapped behind counters and forced to listen to my tales of woe. I show up at the same places and overshare to people who are paid to be pleasant to me until they develop a form of Stockholm syndrome that makes us friends. It was startling to realize that my ham purveyor is a more consistent presence in my life than any friend, family member, or romantic interest. Sometimes I think I need to make some lifestyle changes so that the first person who would realize that I was missing or dead is not the man supporting my ham habit. Other days, when we've had a good gossip and I'm stuffed full of charcuterie and he has given me a pocket sausage for the road, I think I'm doing it right after all. I used to be able to count on my mother to be the one to track me down in the event of my untimely murder. Lord knows she has imagined plenty of gruesome ends for me. I can't tell you the number of times that public safety officers showed up on my doorstep in college because I hadn't returned her calls swiftly enough. Now, she doesn't know how to call my phone number in France. She struggles to put on her seatbelt. Her brain and body and seatbelt just don't click in the right way anymore. 2 months after I moved to France, she learned she had Parkinson's disease, a degenerative brain disorder. My parents told us on Mother's Day. By us, I mean they told my two sisters in person and then, as a family, called me on Skype. Throughout that conversation, my mother's concern was not for herself or her future, but for me, because they were together to process the news while I was alone. It's her greatest fear, one of her children, alone. A fear I have exacerbated by moving overseas. I didn't come here for a relationship. I came here for a job. And when that job ended, I stayed, much to my mother's chagrin. To others, my life in Paris must seem fairly perfect, all croissants and long walks on the Seine. What people don't see? My chronically ill mother sobbing into my neck and begging me not to go. Me getting on that plane anyway, convinced I am some kind of monster. I only have a few more good years left, she says. And it's poignant because it's true. My friend Katie's father found out he had Parkinson's roughly 7 years before my mother, so her family serves as a bellwether. Katie constantly reminds me to appreciate these moments because these are the good years, while the medication still works. Or mostly works. Last year, during 3 months of tonsillitis, I stayed with my parents in Massachusetts for medical care. I had a prescription nasal irrigator that required mineral water. When I requested that my mother purchase some, she proudly returned with a case of carbonated water. I had said mineral, hadn't I? She failed to see why sparkling mineral water was a problem. Yes, these are the good years, I had joked to myself as I waterboarded my sinuses with San Pellegrino so my mother wouldn't feel bad about her brain's inability to put all the pieces together. It's dangerous to define a person by disease. She is a person with Parkinson's, not Parkinson's itself. And by all evaluations, she's doing fairly well. She was able to dance at my younger sister's wedding last October. She got to be at the wedding in the first place. Not everyone is so lucky. And yet, the pain of watching a parent unravel, the grief, amorphous and real, of missing someone even as they stand beside you, takes its toll. I am losing my mother by inches. She's not here. She's still here. However hard it is for us to watch this new reality, it's even more difficult for her to experience it. Despite this, we have been able to maintain a gallows sense of humor in an attempt to productively deal with our pain. For the biennial Parkinson's walk done in her honor, my sister named our team the Movers and Shakers. Because if you can't laugh at your mother's neurodegenerative disease, then what can you laugh at? When I was back in Boston recently, I stopped at her dry cleaner. Seeing that I was alone, the dry cleaner quietly asked if there was something wrong with my mother. She's been coming here for the past 16 years and has always been so bubbly, she said. But now she asks me the same questions over and over. She's slow and careful when she takes out her wallet to pay. I explained about Parkinson's and how there can be a dementia component for many people. She nodded. You don't need to worry about your mother here, she said. We will always take care of her and help her get home. Her offer was so kind, I later cried in my car. It's a constant concern of mine. Who will help her when I am not here? The same concern I imagine that she feels for me. Who will help me when she is not here? My ham man, I want to reassure her, although I doubt that charcuterie holds much solace. You don't need to worry about me, I want to whisper. I have created something from nothing here. I have willed a way of life into being. I have found kinship networks in France that nourish me. My mother was my first country, the first place I ever lived, the poet Naira Wahid once wrote. My mother will always be my first home. But I have learned a second language, a second culture. I have learned how to build a home for myself in the world, and I have learned to be at home within myself. It is not an easy choice to build a life apart from the people I love. The only explanation I can offer is that maybe this is what I have been doing all along, looking for the people who will help me find my way back home, wherever that may be.
That's Jenny Slate reading Catherine Down's essay, Need to Find Me? Ask My Ham Man. Jenny told us why she connected with Catherine's story.
What really moved me about the piece is that at first, you know, this woman is really, she is living my fantasy life. I think in the moments when I want to remove myself into the fantasy, it looks a lot like this. And as you go through the piece and she reveals the more tender truths of what her life is, you know, that's also the natural way that we get to know most people, is that they kind of showcase the best things about their life and how they live it and why they're graceful and good. And then once, you know, they feel safe, they reveal that there's this other thing and will you still love them? I just felt really naturally paired with this way of revealing one's self. And what's nice is that the delights of her life, the ham especially, which is also one of my delights, still feel delightful. And then at the end, learning about her story, I want her to have them even more.
Actor and comedian Jenny Slate. Thanks to Jenny for reading this week's essay. Her new book is called Little Weirds. We'll catch up with Catherine and her ham man after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbons-Neff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Catherine Down's Modern Love essay was published in September of 2018. She says that she didn't want to write a traditional romantic love story.
For me, a lot of the stories that you see about single people are kind of sad or about looking for love or feeling like they're missing something. And that was, for the most part, not my experience. And for me, my love story was not a romantic love story. It was really about falling in love with a place and who I was when I was there. And most of all, it was about learning to love myself. And that was kind of a hard-fought battle, as I think it is for many people. And I wanted something that kind of reflected my reality.
When Catherine learned that her essay was going to be published, she gave it to her mother to read. Catherine told her mom that if she wasn't comfortable with the piece, she would pull it.
I'm so grateful for the fact that she read it and she allowed me to publish it. I think it was painful for her to read. My mother, understandably, has been a little bit in denial about her disease and about the effects on her and the effects on our family as well. And I think it's been easier for her to kind of pretend like it wasn't happening and to stick her head in the sand a little bit. And reading that piece and sort of seeing my words and how it made me feel, I think it forced her to deal with the reality of some of that. One of the things I really appreciate about her is that she read it and she said, okay, this isn't super comfortable for me, but if this draws attention to the disease or gets more funding or if it helps other people, then it's going to be worthwhile.
Catherine says that this year has been a difficult one for her mom.
Last year, right when this piece was being published, my mother was in a traumatic golf cart accident, which I fully realize how ridiculous it sounds. She doesn't even play golf, so it's even more absurd. But it was very traumatic and fairly life-altering for her. Someone just sort of backed up into her at high speed, and she ended up breaking her shoulder. She couldn't sit up on her own for 5 days. She had to relearn how to walk. She was in a rehab facility for several weeks, and it was a very painful recovery. And then actually the bone never healed, and so she had to have a second surgery this summer where she had to have a total shoulder replacement. So it's really been, I think, a very frustrating and painful year for her.
But there have also been some positives. Catherine says that one unexpected consequence of her essay is that it let people in her parents' community know about her mother's illness.
And I think in particular it had a huge effect for my father, who, you know, has been doing a lot of the caretaking duties, and he sent that piece out to every single person he'd ever spoken to, basically. And he sent me all of the responses, and in a lot of them, you know, the message would be like, oh, Jim, I didn't even know Donna was sick. And, you know, as a result, a lot of people started sort of reaching out to him of like, you're going away on a business trip. Maybe we can take her out for dinner one night. And so I think it allowed him to kind of ask for help in a way without feeling like he was asking for help. And I think it allowed people to see, okay, this is what's happening, and maybe there are ways that we can step in to support them.
Catherine says that she's fallen in love with the culture and way of life in Paris and with the work she does there as a food writer, but she still struggles with the distance from her family.
I do feel so much guilt about being so far away from my mother and not being there day to day to help them, but at the same time, I feel so strongly about the life that I'm building, which makes me happy and gives me so much confidence, and I don't want to sacrifice the life I'm building even as I feel the guilt about being so far away from my family. And so it is this kind of constant struggle to build a life that I am proud of, that I also feel proud of in terms of how I care for my parents and how I'm there for them.
More from Catherine and her ham man after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Catherine's ham man Solo joined us partway through this conversation. Catherine was in the U.S. visiting her family for the holidays, and Solo was in a studio in Paris.
Bonjour, bonjour.
Bonjour, mon amour.
How are you?
I'm good. I feel like I'm sitting right next to you.
Parfait, parfait. Maybe Catherine will translate in français. But as I know, she speaks French as a vache espagnole. So it's...
He tells me I speak French like a Spanish cow in vache espagnole, which is a... we're trying to knock someone down a peg.
Solo told us that he was born in Madagascar. He moved to France and met his husband, who owned an antique shop. They spent years traveling together looking for items for the store. And in 2013, Solo opened his own shop, which sold many of the different hams he'd discovered while traveling. And not long after that, he met Catherine.
Elle me fait rire. À chaque fois qu'elle vient, elle me fait rire. Elle est toujours excitée. Catherine explique.
She makes me laugh. She always makes me laugh. She's always excited.
Elle s'arrête et elle est...
She stops.
Voilà, she stops and she stays. And on peut discuter de tout.
We can discuss a little bit of everything.
Pas forcément du travail,
it's not just about work. We talk about life. We talk about... lots of different things. It's not just the commercial side of things.
Et aussi ses amours.
She also talks about her love life. He likes to tease me. I am in a very happy, loving relationship right now, but that has not been the case for the majority of my experience in Paris. And back when I was dating quite a bit, he would always make fun of me and say, oh, she's got a different one every month, which is not correct. I just want to have that on the record. But it was a big deal for me when I brought my current boyfriend to meet him. And it's kind of like meeting my dad, you know? It's not something I would rush into.
Catherine says that it's not unusual to have that kind of close relationship with people who live in the neighborhood.
You know, the neighborhood where his shop is, it really feels like a small village to me. So even though Paris is this enormous city, this particular corner of the Marais, it really feels like a small village and people look out for each other and they check in with each other. And one of my friends from high school came to visit me and she said, I feel like I'm living out the Beauty and the Beast scene where everybody pops their heads out and goes, bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. And the conviviality of that neighborhood overall and then just who he is as a person is so much fun to be around.
And Solo and Catherine say that if listeners are ever in Paris, you should come into the shop for a ham and butter sandwich. Shameless plug, Catherine calls it the best ham and butter sandwich in Paris.
A simple life and simple food. But
simple life of a ham celebrity right here.
Yeah. No, it's not me. The sandwich, yes.
The sandwich and you. You're the perfect package. Come on.
That's Catherine Down and Solofo Ravelasson. Solo's shop is called Caractère de Cochon. Catherine is a food, humor, and travel writer living in Paris. She's currently working on a book. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I get a lot of essays about the single life. And what's interesting to me is how people form families while being single. And time again, I've seen in these stories that we find our families. We make a family from those people who watch out for us. And in some cases, that single person with their sort of networked family is more alive in social settings than the sort of institutionalized couple where a long-term marriage, you can get very lazy socially and inward-looking. And so often it's the single person who makes the family in the community that's more sort of fresh and open. And that just comes so clear in her piece. As she demonstrates in the story, she's doing just fine with many people who love her.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My other job is hosting an NPR show called On Point. Check it out in your podcast feed. We'll see you next week.